and welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Today's narration is Indian Atrocities, Part 3. Death by burning, which appeared to now be my fate, I had resolved to sustain with patience. The divine grace of God had made it less alarming to me, for on my way this day I had been greatly exercised in regard to my latter end. I knew myself to have been a regular member of the church, and to have sought repentance for my sins, but though I had often heard of the faith of assurance, had known nothing of it. But early this day, instantaneously, by a change wrought upon me sudden and perceivable as lightning, an assurance of my peace made with God sprung up in my mind. The following words were the subject of my meditation. In peace thou shalt see God. Fear not those who can kill the body. In peace shalt thou depart. I was on this occasion, by a confidence in mind not to be resisted, fully assured of my salvation. This being the case, I was willing, satisfied, and glad to die. I was tied to the post, as I have already said, and the flame was now kindled. The day was clear, with not a cloud to be seen. If there were clouds low in the horizon, the sides of the house prevented me from seeing them, but I heard no thunder, or observed any sign of approaching rain. Just as the fire of one pile began to blaze, the wind rose. From the time they began to kindle the fire, and to tie me to the post, until the wind began to blow, was about 15 minutes. The wind blew a hurricane, and the rain followed in less than 3 minutes. The rain fell violent, and the fire, though it began to blaze considerably, was instantly extinguished. The rain lasted about a quarter of an hour. When it was over, the savages stood amazed and were a long time silent. At last one said, "We will let him alone until morning, and take a whole day's frolic in burning him." The sun at this time was about 3 hours high. It was agreed upon, and the rope about my neck was untied, and making me sit down, they began to dance around me. They continued dancing in this manner until 11 o'clock at night. In the meantime, beating, kicking, and wounding me with their tomahawks and clubs. At last, one of the warriors, the Half Moon, asked me if I was sleepy. I answered yes. The head warrior then chose out 3 warriors to take care of me. I was taken to a blockhouse. My arms were tied until the cord was hidden in the flesh. They were tied in 2 places around the wrist and above the elbows. A rope was fastened about my neck and tied to a beam of the house, but permitting me to lie down on a board. The 3 warriors were constantly harassing and troubling me, saying, "How will you like to eat fire tomorrow? You will kill no more Indians now." I was in expectation of their going to sleep when at length, about an hour before daybreak, 2 laid down, the 3rd smoked a pipe, talked to me and asked the same painful questions. About 30 minutes after, he also laid down, and I heard him begin to snore. Instantly I went to work, and as my arms were perfectly dead with the cord, I laid myself down upon my right arm, which was behind my back, and keeping it fast with my fingers, which had still some life and strength, I slipped the cord from my left arm over my elbow and my wrist. One of the warriors now got up and stirred the fire. I was apprehensive that I should be examined, and thought it was over with me, but my hopes revived when now he lay down again. I then attempted to unloosen the rope about my neck, tried to gnaw it, but it was in vain, as it was as thick as my thumb and as hard as iron, being made of a buffalo hide. I wrought with it a long time, gave it out, and could see no relief. At this time I saw daybreak and heard the cock crow. I made a 2nd attempt, almost without hope, pulling the rope by putting my fingers between my neck and it, and to my great surprise it came easily untied. It was a noose with 2 or 3 knots tied over it. I slipped over the warriors as they lay, and having got out of the house, looked back to see if there was any disturbance. I then ran through the town into a cornfield. In my way, I saw a squaw with 4 or 5 children lying asleep under a tree. Going in a different way into the field, I untied my arm, which was greatly swollen and turned black. Having observed a number of horses in the glade as I ran through it, I went back to catch one, and on my way found a piece of an old rug or quilt hanging on a fence, which I took with me. Having caught the horse, the rope with which I had been tied served for a halter, I rode off. The horse was strong and swift, and the woods being open and the country level, about 10 o'clock that day, I crossed the Scioto River at a place, by computation, 50 full miles from the town. I had rode about 25 miles on this side of the Scioto by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, when the horse began to fail and could no longer go on a trot. I instantly left him, and on foot ran about 20 miles further that day, making in the whole the distance of near 100 miles. In the evening I heard hallooing behind me, and for this reason did not halt until about 10 o'clock at night, when I sat down, was extremely sick, and vomited. But when the moon rose, which might have been about 2 hours after, I went on and travelled until day. During the night I had a path, but in the morning judged it prudent to forsake the path and take a ridge for the distance of 15 miles in a line at right angles to my course, putting back as I went along with a stick the weeds which I had bent, lest I should be tracked by the enemy. I lay the next night on the waters of Muskingum. The nettles had been troublesome to me after my crossing the Scioto, having nothing to defend myself but the piece of a rug which I had found, and which, while I rode, I used under me by way of a saddle. The briars and thorns were now painful to, and prevented me from, travelling in the night until the moon appeared. In the meantime, I was prevented from sleeping by the mosquitoes, for even in the day I was under the necessity of travelling with a handful of bushes to brush them from my body. The second night I reached Kushikim. Next day came to Newcomer's Town, where I got about 7 raspberries, which were the first thing I ate from the morning on which the Indians had taken me to burn me until this time, which was now about 3 o'clock, the fourth day. I felt hunger very little, but was extremely weak. I swam Muskingum River at Oldcomer's Town, the river being 200 yards wide. Having reached the bank, I sat down, looked back, and thought I had a start of the Indians if any should pursue. That evening I travelled about 5 miles. Next day came to Stillwater, a small river, in a branch of which I got 2 small crawfish to eat. Next night I lay within 5 miles of Wheeling, but had not slept a wink during this whole time, being rendered impossible by the mosquitoes, which it was my constant employment to brush away. Next day came to Wheeling and saw a man on the island in the Ohio opposite to that post, and calling to him, and asking for particular persons who had been on the expedition, and telling him I was Slover, at length, with great difficulty, he was persuaded to come over and bring me across in his canoe. It has been said that the putting to death the Moravian Indians has been the cause of the cruelties practiced on the prisoners taken at Sandusky. But though this has been made an excuse by the refugees among the savages, and by the British, yet it must be well known that it has been the custom of the savages at all times. I have it from Colonel John Campbell, who is lately from Chambly, where he has been in confinement a long time, and was taken on the Ohio some years ago, that 2 men who were taken with him were put to death at the Shawanese towns in the same manner in which Harrison was afterwards executed, viz. By blowing powder into their bodies. A large load blown into the body of one of these men, reaching his kidneys, the pain throwing him into a rage and madness. The savages were uncommonly diverted with the violence of his exclamation and gestures, boys of the town particularly, following him and considering it as excellent sport. In the evening his head was cut off, and an end put to his misery. Colonel Campbell himself was led out to make sport of the same kind, but was saved by the interposition, I think, of Elliot. At the same time, though, I would strike away this excuse which is urged for the savages. I am far from approving the Moravian slaughter. Doubtless the existence of that body of people in our neighbourhood was of disadvantage, as they were under the necessity of receiving and refusing the Sandusky savages as they came to war, and as they returned, and as no doubt some amongst them communicated intelligence of any expedition on foot against the enemy. I am also disposed to believe that the greater part of the men put to death were warriors. This appears from the testimony of one against another, from the confession of many, from their singing the war song when ordered out to be tomahawked, from the cut and painting of their hair, and from other circumstances. The greater part of the Moravian men, who were really peaceable or well affected to us, having been carried off the fall before, and still detained at Sandusky. But the putting to death the women and children, who sang hymns at their execution, must be considered as unjustifiable, inexcusable homicide. And the colonel who commanded the party, and who is said perseveringly, contrary to the remonstrances of officers present, to have enjoyed the perpetration of the act, has not yet been called to an account, and is a disgrace to the state of Pennsylvania. Signed, H. Brackenridge. Mr. Bailey, with the narrative enclosed, I subjoin some observations with regard to the animals vulgarly called Indians. It is not my intention to write any laboured essay, for at so great a distance from the city, and so long unaccustomed to write, I have scarcely resolution to put pen to paper. Having an opportunity to know something of the character of this race of men, from the deeds they perpetrate daily around me, I think proper to say something on the subject. Indeed, several years ago, and before I left your city, I had thought different from some others with respect to the right of soil, and the propriety of forming treaties and making peace with them. In the United States Magazine in the year 1777, I published a dissertation denying them to have a right in the soil. I perceive a writer in your very elegant and useful paper has taken up the same subject under the signature of Caractacus, and unanswerably shown that their claim to the extensive countries of America is wild and inadmissible. I will take the liberty in this place to pursue this subject a little. On what is their claim founded? Occupancy. A wild Indian with his skin painted red and a feather through his nose has set his foot on the broad continent of North and South America. A second wild Indian with his ears cut in ringlets or his nose slit like a swine or a malefactor also sets his foot on the same extensive tract of soil. Let the first Indian make a talk to his brother, and bid him take his foot off the continent, for he, being first upon it, had occupied the whole to kill buffaloes and tall elks with long horns. This claim, in the reasoning of some men, would be just, and the second savage ought to depart in his canoe, and seek a continent where no prior occupant claimed the soil. Is this claim of occupancy of a very early date? When Noah's three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japhet, went out to the three quarters of the old world, Ham to Africa, Shem to Asia, Japhet to Europe, did each claim a quarter of the world for his residence? Suppose Ham to have spent his time fishing or gathering oysters in the Red Sea, never once stretching his leg in a long walk to see his vast dominions from the mouth of the Nile, across the mountains of Ethiopia and the river Niger, to the Cape of Good Hope, where the Hottentots, a cleanly people, now stay, or supposing him, like a Scots peddler, to have travelled over many thousand leagues of that country, would this give him a right to the soil? In the opinion of some men, it would establish an exclusive right. Let a man in more modern times take a journey or voyage like Patrick Kennedy and others to the heads of the Mississippi or Missouri rivers. Would he gain a right ever after to exclude all persons from drinking the waters of these streams? Might not a second Adam make a talk to them and say, "Is the whole of this water necessary to allay your thirst, and may I also drink of it?" The whole of this earth was given to man, and all descendants of Adam have a right to share it equally. There is no right of primogeniture in the laws of nature and of nations. There is reason that a tall man, such as the chaplain in the American army we call the high priest, should have a large spot of ground to stretch himself upon, or that a man with a big belly, like a goodly alderman of London, should have a larger garden to produce beans and cabbage for his appetite, but that an agile, nimble runner, like an Indian called the Big Cat at Fort Pitt, should have more than his neighbours because he has travelled a great space, I can see no reason. I have conversed with some persons and found their mistakes on this subject to arise from a view of claims by individuals in a state of society, who are holding a greater proportion of the soil than others, but this is according to the laws to which they have consented. An individual holding 1 acre cannot encroach on him who has 1,000, because he is bound by the law which secures property in this unequal manner. This is the municipal law of the state under which he lives. The member of a distant society is not excluded by the laws from a right to the soil. He claims, under the general law of nature, which gives a right equally to all, to so much of the soil as is necessary for subsistence. Should a German from the closely peopled country of the Rhine come into Pennsylvania, more thinly peopled, he would be justifiable in demanding a settlement, though his personal force would not be sufficient to effect it. It may be said that the cultivation or melioration of the earth gives a property in it. No, if an individual has engrossed more than is necessary to produce grain for him to live upon, his useless gardens, fields, and pleasure walks may be seized upon by the person who, not finding convenient ground elsewhere, chooses to till them for his support. It is a usual way of destroying an opinion by pursuing it to its consequence. In the present case, we may say that if the visiting 1 acre of ground could give a right to it, the visiting of a million would give a right on the same principle, and thus a few surly, ill-natured men might in the earlier ages have excluded half the human race from a settlement. Or should any have fixed themselves on a territory, visited before they had set a foot upon it, they must be considered as invaders of the rights of others. It is said that an individual building a house or fabricating a machine has an exclusive right to it. And why not those who improve the earth? I would say, should man build houses on a greater part of the soil than falls to his share, I would, in a state of nature, take away a proportion of the soil and the houses from him. But a machine or any work of art does not lessen the means of subsistence to the human race, which an extensive occupation of the soil does. Claims founded on the first discovery of soil are futile. When gold, jewels, manufacturers of any work of men's hands is lost, the finder is entitled to some reward. That is, he has some claims on the thing found, for a share of it. When by industry or the exercise of genius something unusual is invented in medicine or in other matters, the author doubtless has a claim to an exclusive profit by it. But who will say the soil is lost, or that anyone can found a claim by discovering it? The earth with its woods and rivers still exist, and the only advantage I will allow to any individual for having cast his eye first on any particular part of it is the privilege of making the first choice of situation. I would think the man a fool and unjust who would exclude me from drinking the waters of the Mississippi River because he had first seen it. He would be equally so who would exclude me from settling in the country west of the Ohio because in chasing a buffalo he had been first over it. The idea of an exclusive right to the soil in the natives had its origin in the policy of the first discoverers, the kings of Europe. Should they deny the right of the natives from their first treading on the continent, they would take away the right of discovery in themselves by sailing on the coast. As the vestige of the moccasin in one case gave a right, so the cruise in the other was the foundation of a claim. Those who under these kings derived grants were led to countenance the idea, for otherwise why should kings grant or they hold extensive tracts of country? Men become enslaved to an opinion that has been long entertained. Hence it is that many wise and good men will talk of the right of savages to immense tracts of soil. What use do these ring-streaked, spotted, and speckled cattle make of the soil? Do they till it? A revelation said to man, "Thou shalt till the ground." This alone is human life. It is favourable to population, to science, to the information of a human mind in the worship of God. Warburton has well said that before you can make an Indian a Christian, you must teach him agriculture and reduce him to a civilized life. To live by tilling is mor bumano, by hunting is mor best arum. I would as soon admit a right in the buffalo to grant lands as in killbuck, the big cat, the big dog, or any of the ragged wretches that are called chiefs and sachems. What would you think of going to a big lick or place where the beasts collect to lick saline, nitrous, earth and water, and addressing yourself to a great buffalo to grant you land? It is true he could not make the mark of the stone or the mountain reindeer, but he could set his cloven foot to the instrument like the great Ottoman, the father of the Turks, when he put his signature to an instrument. He put his large hand and spreading fingers in the ink and set his mark to the parchment. To see how far the folly of some would go, I had once a thought of supplicating some of the great elks or buffaloes that run through the woods to make me a grant of 100,000 acres of land and prove he had brushed the weeds with his tail and run 50 miles. I wonder if Congress or the different states would recognize the claim. I am so far from thinking the Indians have a right to the soil that, not having made a better use of it for many hundred years, I conceive they have forfeited all pretense to claim and ought to be driven from it. With regard to forming treaties or making peace with this race, there are many ideas. They have the shapes of men, and maybe of the human species, but certainly in their present state they approach nearer the character of devils. Take an Indian. Is there any faith in him? Can you bind him by favours? Can you trust his word or confide in his promise? When he makes war upon you, when he takes you prisoner and has you in his power, will he spare you? In this he departs from the law of nature, by which, according to Baron Montesquieu and every other man who thinks on the subject, it is unjustifiable to take away the life of him who submits. The conqueror, in doing otherwise, becomes a murderer who ought to be put to death. On this principle, are not the whole Indian nations murderers? Many of them may have not had an opportunity of putting prisoners to death, but the sentiment which they entertain leads them invariably to this when they have it in their power or judge it expedient. These principles constitute them murderers, and they ought to be prevented from carrying them into execution, as we would prevent a common homicide, who should be mad enough to conceive himself justifiable in killing men. The tortures which they exercise on the bodies of their prisoners justify extermination. Gilo of Syria made war on the Carthaginians because they oftentimes burnt human victims, and made peace with them on conditions they would cease from this unnatural and cruel practice. If we could have any faith in the promises they make, we could suffer them to live, provided they would only make war amongst themselves and abandon their hiding or lurking on the pathways of our citizens, emigrating unarmed and defenceless inhabitants, and murdering men, women, and children in a defenceless situation, and on their ceasing in the meantime to raise arms no more among the American citizens. And there we finish with Indian Atrocities. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for more Albion Narrations at RadioAlbion.com.
radio.